Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, and today we're going to take a look back at some of the developments in the true crime world that have transpired over the course of the past year. Of course, 2022 has been a difficult ride for many, and personally, I'm on the verge of burnout between this podcast and my creative projects, so I thought we'd take a little stroll through memory lane, heading into the holidays, and also talk about the year to come. I'm going to resume with normal programming next week as we delve into the rabbit hole known as the Long Island serial killer case, something I foreshadowed with the Shannon Gilbert episode last week. As many of you know, Shannon's case is one in which some people are under the impression she was murdered by the serial killer, while others, such as the police, believe she succumbed to an unfortunate accident that is, strangely, unrelated, even though the search for her remains uncovered a series of other victims, all seemingly linked to a single perpetrator. So, I'm looking forward to that case, but in the meantime, let's indulge a bit of retrospect. Perhaps the most sensational news of 2022 was the recent arrest of 50-year-old Delphi, Indiana resident Richard Allen, known as Ricky, in connection with the murders of 14-year-old Liberty German and 13-year-old Abigail Williams, two girls who were murdered below the Monon High Bridge in 2017. Authorities, as has been their disposition since the beginning, are remaining tight-lipped about the details surrounding this arrest, but what we do know is that he will be charged with two counts of murder, which would obviously be in relation to each of the victims. With that said, however, we don't know the extent of his involvement in the case, meaning that when children are involved, especially those who have been solicited online, that information is often recycled or made available for sharing by other predators. It's a long-standing tradition that men seeking child victims often work together, as the nature of what they're seeking is taboo. In the past, such endeavors actually required those creeps to work hand in hand, and in cases such as the Oakland County child killer, we have witnesses seeing various men in different vehicles in possession of the kids. In today's world, discretion needs to be greater due to the overwhelming presence of video surveillance that is making criminal activity increasingly difficult to perpetrate without the aid of deception. In that light, the safest place to troll for kids, so to speak, is online, specifically social media, a place where kids try to exclude their parents from their burgeoning sexual desires and earliest ventures to find love. So in the Oakland County child killer case, in the 1970s, it was learned that a lot of men in that region belonged to a subscription mailing service in which creeps would be sent the addresses of young children, sometimes with photos. In the Johnny Gosch case, one of the suspects kept a notebook in his home filled with the names, numbers, and addresses of local children. It served as a directory of options prior to the implementation of the internet. Now, however, technology has created a situation in which a predator can do things like create fake profiles, alter IP addresses, use burner phones, and so on, allowing them to circumvent the previous methods of dangerously exposing their identities by appearing in public. A couple of weeks after the Delphi murders, a young man who fits such a profile, Keegan Klein, had his home raided in Peru, Indiana, a place where he lived with his father, Tony. The police collected laptops, phones, and other such electronics deemed perhaps relevant to the murders, as well as a litany of other potential infractions related to the solicitation of minors. At the time, this wasn't widely discussed by the public, or even known to a great extent. We became well aware of the Kleins, however, in December 2021, when a state trooper in one of those ridiculous hats appeared on TV to ask for the public's assistance in identifying the owner of a social media account known as Anthony Shots. Keegan Klein was the person behind that account, in terms of being the creator, but the police believed, due to seeing two different types of communication on the messages and different login times, that the profile was being used by two people, if not more. He had, in fact, been in contact with Liberty German in the days leading up to her death, and meeting up was discussed, but ultimately there was no evidence to prove he was the killer or that he had actually met with her. And the cops didn't think he was the man on the bridge either. Klein was never actually called a suspect, while a lot of other people were, and it's because, even though he's a sociopath and pathological liar, if he had been the person on the bridge, his sloppiness and carelessness would have rendered him caught immediately, as we can see by the fact that his home was raided within a couple of weeks. Of course, the element of this case that ignited the sensationalism is that there was a full-body, broad-daylight video of the killer on the Monon High Bridge, captured by Libby's phone, which led to the killer being dubbed Bridge Guy. It was entirely obvious Keegan Klein was not this man, as the person on the bridge was clearly both middle-aged and short. Keegan Klein turned out to be nearly two decades younger, and therefore a lot of people tried to point the finger at his father, Tony. But while Tony is middle-aged, he's also 6 feet tall and a giant compared to Bridge Guy. The same goes for neighbor Ron Logan, who was nothing less than a giant in comparison to the actual perpetrator. I'm not exactly sure how anyone took the bait on either Klein being Bridge Guy, due to those reasons, but the better part of those interested in true crime wanted to believe it despite obvious inconsistencies which made their assertions impossible. Keegan did not fit the age bracket. Ron was way too tall. Tony was also way too tall. I had a lot of difficulty conveying these ideas in a way that made any difference, but hopefully everybody can now see that Ricky Allen, at 5 feet 4 inches tall and middle-aged, is the type of person we were looking for. Now, we were all wrong about our choice of suspect, and simply because we, as the public, don't get to choose from the general public, nor do we get to peruse the evidence outside of what's released. We look at the suspect pool. So there isn't a way for you and I, as outsiders, to be like, oh yeah, Ricky Allen, the pharmacy tech down at the local CVS. Until he was caught, we didn't know of him, and so our speculation has to fall within the parameters of known suspects. We were looking for a short, middle-aged man with a wide, round face, wide lower jaw, slightly pointed upper ear, larger, round belly, and facial hair exclusive of the sides of the face, meaning a goatee or stash, and not a beard. My choice among the official suspects was Sheriff Tobe Lesenby because he fits that description perfectly. His behavior surrounding the investigation, from calling off the dogs to being terrified of the cameras to now being sued by one of his own deputies in relation to the case, struck me as being indicative of poor character at best and guilt at worst. Months ago, I also received another message from a different person who had also named him in a lawsuit alleging violations of the Hatch Act and similar related to the recent campaign for electing a new sheriff. Just think of this. Ricky Allen lived 0.3 miles from the crime scene, and Tobe Lesenby called off the dogs from coming to follow his scent. If I had to do it over again, a million times, I would choose the same suspect, as the combination of physical traits and poor character, along with the seeming desire to break the law by utilizing his influence, are suspicious. Now, most of what we, as the public, want to know is sealed by court order for the time being, and so a lot of questions remain. We assume, based upon physicality and the charges against Richard Allen, that he is the person, at least allegedly, known as Bridge Guy, and that the secrecy surrounding what seems to be cut and dry is the lingering notion that he might have a connection to the Kleins, or even other local predators, that served as the conduit to him receiving the information about Abby and Libby. How did he know they would be at the bridge that day? Was he interacting with Libby already, or did he acquire that knowledge from another predator? If he did get it from others, was it supplied to him in the sense of, hey, fellow creep, I know of some children willing to meet up? We don't know. Or did he just come across this information accidentally because it was available? Undoubtedly, a lot of this will come out in the wash, but given the secrecy, it seems this might be a prolonged process of weeding out any number of predators, and perhaps even something ongoing that doesn't ever quite resolve itself because its origin isn't based in one case, but a single issue, which is abusing children. And when we're talking about that subject, there are endless predators. So I look forward to hearing and seeing the revelations as we move forward, but I don't think this event is going to have a tidy conclusion where we wrap a bow on top. It likely involves many more victims and violations and people, and so for now, what is obviously most important is that the families and friends of the victims have some answers. There will be justice. It doesn't change anything for Libby and Abby, rest in peace, but the good that comes from their advocacy might save the life of another child, and another after that. That's the importance of looking in the rearview, of committing to finding answers about days long gone by. The future. Now, the last bit of curiosity here is wondering how they caught the guy. Rumor has it that the authorities did some digging in Ricky's backyard, specifically in the fire pit, and there are several rumors as to what might have been found. Some say it might have been burned clothing fragments or a similar souvenir that could be personally connected to either or both of the victims. On the other hand, the detectives had earlier mentioned that they had physical evidence, but that it wasn't what we, the public, would expect. Now, when the arrest happened, people flooded the Facebook page of Ricky's wife in order to speculate about the context of what was going on and so forth. Two things of note were mentioned above all else. One is that she had removed all of her photos from 2017, the year of the murders. And if you looked at the entries for late 2016, in the holiday season, Ricky was featured in no fewer than two videos in which he appeared to be wearing Bridge Guy's blue coat. Now, we can't definitively say that was the jacket, but it looks like it. Of greater note, however, is that Allen's family had suffered the loss of a pet in the last few years, which was a black cat that died. Therefore, a rumor has persisted that the physical evidence we wouldn't expect was DNA related to cat hair, making the excursion into Allen's yard, one in which they were actually exhuming the cat and not digging up the fire pit. Of course, both of those things could be true, or conversely, perhaps neither of them are the real reason law enforcement was there. Obviously, the greater question is what led them to do that. In the time preceding the arrest, Keegan Klein had been removed from jail and supposedly assisted law enforcement with something that might or might not have led them to searching the Wabash River near his home in Peru, Indiana. So is there a connection between the two men? Or even to Keegan's father, Tony, who was much closer to Allen's age? Quite possibly. It's also just as reasonable to believe that Allen might have simply acted on information posted somewhere by Klein, or even that someone else viewing or otherwise aware of Klein's info about Libby going to the bridge informed Allen. There are so many possibilities, and we're mostly kept in the dark by law enforcement, which makes this case susceptible to the greatest extent of secrecy and speculation. We're all throwing darts at the board, hoping they'll stick, but in truth, that collective effort serves not to solve the case, but simply to facilitate continuing awareness. There are a lot of people who want true crime to be a place of blind empathy in which nothing is considered but feeling for the victim. But the cost of believing such a world can exist and trying to implement it is going to render a hard lesson in which you learn something you ironically already knew, which is that drama and not being nice is what captures eyeballs. It's what gets attention. We need everybody to create this awareness, from the audacious, opinionated assholes like myself, to the crackpots, to the people who are intent upon employing blind empathy. All of that combined is what facilitates the interest. That's what creates the drama, the chaos. Without it, there's no reason to look. There is only one game. There is only one market, attention. So I look forward to learning more in this case, and I'm sure as we head into 2023 and Alan's trial approaches, along with Keegan Klein's, we'll have much more to talk about. In the meantime, let's be thankful this clown is off the street and that the loved ones of the victims will continue to get answers. It seems Ricky Allen will be represented by an attorney named Andrew Baldwin and his team, who were court-appointed due to financial reasons. Allen has stated that this hardship of being arrested has led to unemployment for both him and his wife, and that his wife, for reasons of safety, has had to abandon their home. On a final note, and perhaps the creepiest one, Libby's grandparents ended up remembering that in the aftermath of the murders, when they were printing photos of the girls at the local CVS, Ricky Allen had been the person who helped them free of charge. He let them leave without paying for the photos in question, as though he was doing them a favor. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever started building something new that you bought, trying to assemble all the strange pieces to find the right connections that fit, and suddenly found yourself lost because you misplaced the user manual, leaving you without a solid plan for moving forward to achieve your goal? I think we all have. But what's especially difficult is that life, specifically when it comes to our emotional world, doesn't offer a user manual. So when you get stuck, the solution isn't as simple as turning to chapter 3, page 27. Thankfully, therapists are trained to help you figure out the cause of challenging emotions and learn productive coping skills, which makes therapy the closest thing to a guided tour of the complex engine called you. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/CCMM. That's betterhelp, H-E-L-P, .com/CCMM. Now, of course, another sensational development this year, one that many people are happy about but has left me with steam blowing out my ears, is the release of Adnan Syed, who had been incarcerated for the murder of his ex-girlfriend, Haemin Lee, since 1999. Now, I, like everybody else, was told that Adnan was going to be released and not tried again due to exculpatory DNA evidence that excluded him as the perpetrator. Yet, as I expected, when the announcement came, that turned out to be a lie facilitated politically instead of physically. If Adnan Syed has already been convicted of the crime, then what I would need to see in order to use the word innocent, as his supporters staunchly claim, is proof of innocence. Instead, what I got was Baltimore State's attorney Marilyn Mosby telling me Adnan was innocent because his DNA was not on the victim's shoes? That's a political assertion, and not physical. But respectfully, if you're in the Adnan cult, you don't care. All you want is your cake. You are the person watching the football game and not caring that the refs made a bad call because it helps your team. You don't care how the cake gets on your plate. I get it. I understand. But that is, by definition, cult-like behavior. You've decided that a person is innocent using a standard not conducive to proving it true. It's just ridiculous. So I'm looking at Marilyn Mosby, jaw dropped, and thinking to myself, how could you do this? How could you stoop to shilling like this? I mean, I know a PR stunt when I see one. In all honesty, if they had legitimately proven in any way that Adnan Syed was innocent, I would be more than happy to be wrong and admit it. The truth is the most important thing here, which is why when I saw Marilyn Mosby get down on her knees like that, I immediately knew she was in trouble. So I Googled four little words, charges against Marilyn Mosby, and guess who has a trial coming up in 2023? A trial that was supposed to have occurred by now, but got delayed twice despite her representation vehemently arguing against pushing it back to March 2023. That would be Marilyn Mosby. Of course, it's not a secret why her reps were livid about the date being pushed back to March 2023, as Marilyn will be leaving office in January of the coming year, leaving her in a position of being judged in the absence of the significant leverage her prior office afforded. Now, she didn't exactly commit murder. In fact, it seems like this is a case of political sabotage by a rival, or rivals, as the infraction for which she was caught is related to lying about a loan from her husband on a real estate application, leading to her seemingly perjuring herself. She had moved money from one place to another to make the transaction more advantageous for her and claimed $5,000 was a gift from her husband, when in truth, it was nothing of the sort. Now, Mosby made her name publicly in the Freddie Gray case years ago, but Adnan's case is equally sensational and, more than anything else, recent. So if you're Marilyn Mosby and have a trial coming up, which type of PR move do you think your people are going to recommend? Doing the right thing by continuing to pursue Adnan Syed? Or join the cult and assert innocence on a technicality that actually has nothing to do with guilt or innocence? The lack of Adnan's DNA on Hayes' shoes means absolutely nothing at all. It means nothing. But if you have a trial coming up and are a well-known public figure, your people are going to tell you to please the cult and allow lenience, forgiveness, and freedom to rule the day. If you're her, you want to be remembered for these things so that they're fresh in the memories of the people in the legal system who will be judging you as you head toward trial. You don't want to go to trial being perceived as unwilling, stubborn, and unforgiving, as it might have a direct impact upon the outcome of events. So I woke up that day to endless celebrations of cult members freely using the word innocent to describe Adnan Syed and believing his innocence had been proven, and yet it is a fact that absolutely nothing of the sort took place. everybody conspired to say that it was true, and therefore they all believe it. But his innocence was absolutely never proven. A woman in trouble, one in a place of power, used her influence to assert innocence in a situation in which it had never been proven. All I need to witness is some type of exculpatory evidence, but none has been presented to this point. The cries of justice for Hay, which were loud and proud when Syed was locked up, have fallen silent now that there isn't actually a real killer to catch. Cult members believe this case was solved by DNA, leading to Adnan's release. And yet here we are with that DNA, and there is no other perpetrator, nor will there be. Why? Because there can't be, so the cult will remain quiet. I'm not a bad person for requesting that the standard for proving innocence involves evidence that actually proves innocence instead of satisfying political requirements. I don't give a shit about the politics. I care about the truth. And the truth is that, to this day, and from a physical standpoint, there is no exculpatory evidence to prove Adnan Syed innocent. Furthermore, there is no other viable suspect, despite an assertion of having DNA evidence. The cult keeps pointing to a wild conspiracy involving a pedophilic dentist, but if they know who it is and have the DNA, just go grab the guy. What are you waiting for? And in reality, it's all bullshit. But again, I am always more than happy to indulge the truth, even at the cost of being wrong. Yet in this case, the only truth I can extract is the obvious notion that people care more about wanting Adnan to be innocent than knowing if he actually is. And it's a problem because the truth must be objective. Your opinion can be as subjective as you want it to be, but the truth, the absolute truth, must be objective. We are all locked away inside our emotional world and suffering for crimes we didn't commit and want freedom from that place. But when you make an emotional theme relevant to factual information, it's a fairy tale. People latch on to false imprisonments or wrongful convictions to indulge that powerful theme and overcome the implications, and that is the basis for sociopaths manipulating the public into believing they're really innocent when they're not. When people want to believe, all you have to supply is a reason. So as I watch Marilyn Mosby indulging the necessity of objective truth, and cult members are watching the same thing, the information is disseminated to our brains in different ways. The cult members are going to believe what they want to believe, and all that is required for doing so is some type of nugget of information that can be politically twisted into a pretzel to convey the theme of being wrongfully convicted. So that becomes the DNA on the shoes. But it absolutely does not prove innocence. Unless you want it to, like the public, or need it to, like Marilyn Mosby heading to trial for her own poor behavior. She's literally going to trial for lying, and people are like, she's proving to us that Adnan's innocent. No, she did no such thing. Because in a situation in which she didn't want to be pursued any further regarding her own wrongdoings, the best move, by far, and from a political standpoint, is to not pursue the case any further. But in doing that, what happens is that the people trying to uphold the standard of objective truth proven by innocence are turned on by the cult, who call them bad people, leave one-star reviews, and say nasty things. So, I believe that's the end of the line for justice in the case. I think the notion that the quote-unquote real killer is going to be unveiled is absolutely hysterical. It isn't because I'm a bad person. It isn't because I'm out to get Adnan. I'm not. It's because their truth is simply not objective, which is fine for matters of the heart, but not for things judged in a courtroom. I'll be here waiting for updates and perfectly willing to believe real evidence. Now, moving along, perhaps another case potentially gaining steam toward a conclusion is the murder of JonBenet Ramsey. Now, my personal opinion is the same as that of the grand jury assembled in this case. I believe both John and Patsy Ramsey conspired to alter a crime scene in which their son Burke had killed their daughter JonBenet in a fit of rage, specifically with a hard strike to the head by an object such as a flashlight or a golf club. Now, public sentiment seems to be leaning back the other way these days, as there's a push to retest certain items for DNA and also test other items for the first time. Could there have been an intruder in the home that night? Sure. Yet, as the public, we were able to watch the Ramseys build a fortress of lawyers and legal protection that went so far beyond the scope of reason that there was actually no contact between the Ramseys and the Boulder police from January 1997 to April or May of the same year. In a situation in which their daughter had been kidnapped and murdered in their home, or at least it seemed to have happened like that, the Ramseys were so offended by the scrutiny that they put up a brick wall between them and the only people who could ascertain the truth. They have dodged all the difficult questions and even put their son on Dr. Phil so that he could dodge anything a person might want to know. It's always been smoke and mirrors and never transparency, something fueled by money and white privilege to the extent that even when the impartial grand jury handed down indictments for both parents, the district attorney lied to the public and asserted that there wasn't enough evidence to proceed with any charges. In 2013, when the records were unsealed, we learned that was all lies. Deception, lying, and avoidance were the Ramsey game plan from day one, and their false assertion that the police were only looking at them made it worse. The police were looking at them because that's where the evidence led and nowhere else, so clearly their focus isn't going to change. The Ramseys, however, were only going to cooperate if the police went in a different direction, away from the evidence. But I think we see from the grand jury indictments that Boulder police had every reason to not budge. Of course, the most controversial aspect of the case is the DNA evidence, of which there is very little to this point and is limited to touch DNA. We do not know that this DNA is related to a crime, and furthermore, it's believed that the underwear on which that touch DNA appeared might have been new, straight from the package. In testing such products directly from the manufacturers without first being washed at home, it was proven that male touch DNA is commonly found in brand new women's, or in this case, girls' underwear. The Ramseys, of course, lost everything due to this sensational event, from their daughter to their lavish lifestyle, and one has to wonder if the effort to keep this case alive is more of a financial grab, such as suing CBS for $800 million. It seemed as though this matter would never officially be solved, but now we might get an answer. Was there an intruder in the Ramsey home? Or is it a lie? We'll see. But the one thing we can say for sure is that if the Ramseys were truly invested in knowing who killed their daughter back in December 1996, then they would have done whatever they needed to do to avail themselves of suspicion to allow the Boulder police to move on from them. However, after only perhaps three conversations with the couple, and before the new year of 1997 arrived, only days after the death, the Ramseys were already shutting the police out, and would do so for the next 4 or 5 months, meaning that whatever the Boulder police did that hampered the investigation, if anything, was employed by the Ramseys tenfold in their efforts to stop it. And if we examine what that legal wall, that fortress of security, amounted to, the answer, quite simply, is silence. And that, not anything that the Boulder police did, is the reason this case remains unsolved. It is on the Ramseys 100%. No matter the truth, it is a fact that the Ramseys did more to hinder the case than the police, and by a mile, it's not even close. They are at fault for that. Every other person who isn't a rich, influential white man has to get harassed by the police during investigations, but because they did it to John Ramsey, we're asked to behave like this is out of the ordinary and that the police did something horrible, something that was way out of bounds. They didn't. The Ramseys' money bought that false perception, and we see that truth evident in the grand jury proceedings leading to indictments. The Ramseys seem guilty of the crime. That's why police focused on them. That's where the evidence went. If they were not guilty and had nothing to hide, why not just be transparent and thorough instead of taking 5 months of silence to build your story as you bitch about the Boulder Police Department demanding more than 3 conversations with you in a situation that involves the murder of your daughter? Like, can you seriously not just grin and bear it? So what if they're going at you? They're supposed to. They are supposed to clear you first, and it doesn't always happen in the first couple of conversations, especially in a very complex and sensational case like this one. That's just my 2 cents. Could there have been an intruder in the house? Sure, but if there really was, this family might go down as the dumbest people in history because they will be responsible for literally bringing the investigation to a screeching halt for months just to satisfy their pride of being wealthy and white and therefore worthy of being immune to harsh scrutiny of any kind. When the police ask you to cooperate in a murder investigation, you better be ready to indulge them in truth up to and including the color of your fucking underwear, because for everything you hide, you make their jobs harder. The Ramseys bullied the Boulder police and then gaslit them and did the same to the public, and it's exactly the reason that police department has been reluctant for the better part of the last 3 decades to take further action to resolve the case. Now, again, anything could be true here. The Ramseys could be entirely innocent. But again, it is evident to me that their efforts to stifle the police, very simply, stifled the result of finding justice for JonBenet. Why would they do that? That's a question we all have to ask for ourselves as of now. Maybe someday soon, we'll get an answer. We'll see. This podcast is sponsored by HelloFresh. What is HelloFresh? With HelloFresh, you get farm-fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's #1 meal kit. The holidays are just around the corner, and HelloFresh makes this busy time of year easier than ever with chef-crafted recipes and pre-portioned ingredients delivered right to your door so you can spend less time meal planning and prepping. Save money on dinner with HelloFresh and put it toward your holiday shopping. HelloFresh is cheaper than grocery shopping and 25% less expensive than takeout. As your calendar starts to fill up this season, you can count on HelloFresh to get you some of your free time back by making cooking simple and quick. Each recipe and its pre-portioned ingredients come right to your door, so you can skip the grocery store and a lot of the prep. Need dinner in a hurry? HelloFresh's quick and easy options, like 20-minute meals and easy cleanup recipes, allow you to enjoy good times around the dinner table with loved ones and less time in the kitchen. On a personal note, as someone who is both short on time and talent in the kitchen, HelloFresh being delivered right to my doorstep and offering simple, step-by-step instructions along with the ingredients for creating a tasty meal was a very pleasant experience, to say the least, giving me one less thing to worry about in my busy day. Go to HelloFresh.com/CCMM65 and use code CCMM65 for 65% off plus free shipping. Again, that's HelloFresh.com/CCMM65 and use code CCMM65 for 65% off plus free shipping. Of course, all of you have your own opinions about these cases, many that are quite different than mine, and again, that's what creates the drama leading to more public awareness and pressure on law enforcement, which can often be the push a case needs to head in the direction of objective truth. If the victims and their stories are never forgotten, the plight for justice remains. So while we come at this endeavor from different angles, the one commonality that connects us all is our empathy for being a mortal, vulnerable human living in a world where love sometimes falls prey to evil. And with that, finally, I just want to talk about another subject moving into 2023, which is you. I've been thinking a lot about my goals and how 2022 has been a really tough year, one that was preceded by a couple that were certainly no easier as we faced a global pandemic and the accompanying fallout. Things have changed. Many people find themselves displaced and/or in a point of transition, and that can lead to uncertainty or worse. Some of the lowest points in my life have come since 2019, with one incident after another in which I feel like I'm getting hammered over the head and ending up further from the places of happiness I'd envisioned for myself. I think what's worst about it is the silence, especially silence in places where we once had hope. I was on the verge of really making some dreams come true, and those things suddenly fell apart. I encountered some people who pretended to care for me, but preferred instead to subject me to abuse in exchange for potential opportunities. It was heartbreaking. It still is. And sometimes I feel lost, other times angry, even hopeless. But if there's one thing I recognize, above all else, it's that I have not stopped fighting. And I will not quit. Those things will happen for me. Those who hurt me, they know it too. They could not break me as much as they wanted to. And I'm still in the fight. I'm getting stronger. I'm coming for what I believe is mine, what I worked for, dreamed about, and bled over, even if only in tears. I'm coming. But out there right now, somebody is listening, maybe even many people, and it's someone who lost their way, fell down, and couldn't get back up. I've been there. There were times that I couldn't get up and keep moving. They were lonely. I desperately hoped someone would realize and come back to get me, come back to lift me up and get me on my feet again. If only they could see I was there. It was like being behind a wall in the dark, screaming for help that can only be echoed back at you to prove you're alone in this. So for anyone who is in that place now, I just want you to know that you have the strength to break down that wall and escape. There is freedom on the other side. And though you might not be able to see them now, there are people cheering you on to succeed. Because somewhere, and at some point in time, they were you and will be again. So if you can find the strength to get back to your feet and fight, you might lose the next battle, or even the next 10. But you'll be left standing at the end of the war. Within that notion, there are two things that truly create our identity and allow us to be symbolically reborn. What we have survived, and what we have become because of that pain. This means that right now, as you're trapped inside the cocoon of loneliness and uncertainty of transformation, outside that world of darkness is one in which, when you reemerge, there will not only be light, but you will have grown wings. And with them, as you had always dreamed, you'll finally be able to fly.